Once the case got brought back to Montgomery County, we began the preparations for the trial. Remember, we had led the Joint Sniper Task Force, so we had all the evidence. We begun to prepare for the trial of John Muhammad when we received a letter from Malvo. The letter said that he wanted to come in and talk to us and tell us what happened and why. We were very suspicious of that, of course, at the beginning, but we figured might as well listen to what he had to say. So he literally came into my office, not my building, not the floor, but into my very office in the state's attorney's office in Rockville, and it was guarded heavily by sheriffs and the like. And we began to talk, and I had no idea. What do you say to a cold-blooded killer that's sitting, you know, 6 feet away from you who you're in the process of prosecuting? So I said, how are you passing time? To break the ice, I said, how are you passing time? He said, well, I read a lot. I said, what are you reading now? And he said, The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand. And I was somewhat amazed that that's what he would be reading. And we ended up talking about the difference between Peter Keating and Howard Roark, the two main characters in The Fountainhead. And I realized that sitting in front of me was somebody who was very highly intelligent, very articulate, very thoughtful, yet was a cold-blooded killer. And what are we going to do about that? His lawyers knew about the visit, and remember, he was a juvenile when these cases were committed. So his lawyers knew about it. They, you know, he clearly had talked to them, and he clearly wanted to get all this off his chest. His lawyers agreed to the meeting, but they were not in the room with him. It was just myself, my chief deputy, and a bunch of sheriffs. And so, and actually, I think it was also the other prosecutor who tried the case as well. And we were in the room, and I was, began the conversation with them. And we really wanted to, well, there were two things we were trying to determine. One was we wanted to learn more. You know, we wanted to learn more about the why and the how than they certainly learned in Virginia. They really didn't learn very much in Virginia. It was much more of a demonstration of the evidence regarding that one murder in that one jurisdiction regarding Muhammad and the one murder in the one jurisdiction regarding Malvo. But we didn't really, they didn't really dig deep into the motives and what happened and why. We were trying to get two things. One, we wanted to learn a lot of information about what happened, how it happened, when it happened, the sequence. And second, to assess his veracity. It was this, what was he trying to get? Why was he going from the guy who was completely under the auspices of Muhammad and looked at him as a father figure and tried to literally escape when we brought him in, to this person who reached out to us that now wanted to talk to us? What did he have to gain by that? Remember, the death penalty by that time was no longer available to juveniles because the Supreme Court had said so. There was really not much he could get from us. We wanted to figure out what it was that he was in it for him. And really what was in it for him at this point that we later learned was he just felt really bad about what happened and wanted to do whatever he could to try and make it right. Now, he was clearly not going to be able to make it right. He wasn't going to bring any of those lives back, and he certainly wasn't going to be able to repair the havoc that he caused on the community. But I guess this was his one time to relieve the emotion and the passion and the issues that were weighing him down in that while he had sat in jail these 2 years.
Did his letter say he wanted to plead?
He said he wanted to talk. He said quite the contrary. He said he wanted to talk and he didn't want anything from us regarding that. And so we spent hours and hours and hours with him. And we realized that he was telling us the truth because he knew things that only the shooter would have known. Only the people that had committed this crime would have known. And the evidence that he was telling us about, for example, the shooting in Arizona on the golf course and what evidence was left behind, was clearly true because the evidence matched his story, and his story would only be known by the person who committed the crime.
In Virginia, prosecutors had said that Malvo did most of the shooting, but you learned that that wasn't the case, right?
He was telling us exactly who did what, where, and when. He was telling us who did the shooting on which murders. He told us how that came about. It was a full dissertation from beginning in Tacoma, Washington, as they went throughout the country committing murder after murder and robbery after robbery until they settled into our region and, you know, committed the 10 murders that they committed in our region.
What was Malvo's demeanor when he was sitting in your office?
His demeanor was very matter of fact. It was devoid of emotion, devoid of passion, but seemingly extremely sincere and very detailed. He clearly had thought about what had happened and had, you know, a tremendous recall as to what happened. And so we sort of went through it day by day and sometimes hour by hour, in particular phone calls that they had made and where they had eaten in between, you know, on certain days, and where they went after they did a shooting and so forth. And then, you know, we talked about, remember, during the course of this, they sort of evolved into asking for ransom money and the sort of the stakes had changed. It started in Tacoma, Washington, came across the country. By the time it got here, the motive seemed to change. The motive was truly one of terror, to exact terror upon the community. Remember, this was 1 year after 9/11, and these were all they wanted to do was terrorize the community. They were true domestic terrorists, not aligned necessarily with the Taliban or anything like that, but Muhammad had a real hatred for white people and for our society, and felt that he was a victim of our society and wanted to give back and by creating this terror. That changed a little bit during the course of the murders as they realized, as they saw the hysteria grow and grow, and you know the amount of coverage it got on television. You recall, this was after O.J. Simpson, but it still was at a time when cable television was growing, and there was a need to have talking heads on television 24 hours a day, and they would watch, as the rest of us did, these people pontificating about who might have committed this crime and been white military, ex-military guys from the Aspen Hill area of Montgomery County that were driving a white box truck. And of course, none of that was true. And they began to sort of start a game of cat and mouse. What was going to be their next response? What was their next move going to be? It was almost like a chess game. They at one point decided we should make some money out of this, and they sent those ludicrous ransom notes. But they were clearly listening. They were paying attention. They'd be sitting in Denny's eating food, watching the television. They were not targeting any particular people. They were not targeting any particular type of person, including age, and that's when they shot the child. Well, it was clear that Muhammad was driving this whole process, literally and figuratively, and Malvo really did view him as a father figure and followed along, committing a lot of the acts, many of the shootings, but also was sort of under his guise. It felt like he couldn't stop it and really didn't want to stop it. He didn't feel remorse during the course of it, and he didn't feel remorse after his arrest. It was after some time they'd been separated, they'd gone through trials, and at that point, Malvo reached out to us, and that's when we had the initial meeting with him.
So despite his taking part in these killings, you believed what Malvo had to say?
After spending literally dozens of hours interviewing Malvo, learning information from him, and assessing his veracity, that is, did we, the prosecutors, believe him enough to promote his testimony, to put him on the stand and allow him to testify? And second, did we want him to? In other words, we knew that we could get the convictions on those six murders without his testimony. We knew whether he testified or not, we would be able to convict Muhammad. And Malvo was willing to plea at that time. So the question is, were we going to put him on the stand, and what was the plea going to be? Remember, the only thing available to us was life without the possibility of parole for Malvo, because he'd been a juvenile at the time of the shootings. And we ultimately decided that the community and the victims' families deserved to hear from Malvo. They deserved their day in court. They deserved to hear exactly what happened, when it happened, and how it happened, and why it happened. So although it was a slight risk to put him on the stand, that is, he could have completely spun us and so forth, we decided to take that risk, given the mountain of evidence that we had forensically and from eyewitness testimony and other circumstantial evidence, that we could put him on the stand and take that risk. And we're awfully glad we did that. Ultimately, the judge that tried the case called it the perfect trial. It cost very, very little money, you know, less than $2,000 in expenditures. And the community had to stay in court, and we got to hear from Malvo. Now, That was the plea as to our six cases. Malvo was willing to, and we wanted him to, plead every murder and every crime that they committed across the United States, because we felt that the victims' families that were not in Maryland deserved their day in court and deserved to hear what in fact happened, how it happened, and why it happened. His lawyers were involved. They wanted him to do it. We wanted him to do it. And he wanted to do it. The problem was we needed the Virginia prosecutors to sign off on it. We spoke with the prosecutors around the country in the different jurisdictions where the murders happened, and they were all very much in favor of it because they knew they were not going to get an independent day in court. And so that they wanted their families and their victims to know what happened and how it happened and why it happened. So they were willing to be there for that plea. The way the plea was going to work was he was going to plead to every case that happened, every murder that happened beginning in Tacoma, Washington, across the country into our area, concluding with the murder that occurred in the District of Columbia. The reason why that would be is because any time there's a murder in D.C., the defendant goes to federal prison. And all Malvo wanted out of this whole ordeal was to not have to serve his time at Red Onion Prison in Southern Virginia.
Why was it so important for him to get out of Red Onion?
He was being abused. He was being mistreated. The fact of the matter is he was going to and will spend the rest of his life in an 18 by 18 foot cage behind bars, whether it's in a federal prison or in Virginia or any other prison. And so we felt that it was not a concession at all. In fact, given the very nature of these crimes, the national flavor of the crimes, of course, they were not federal crimes, but they took place all across the United States in so many different states, that we felt that that would be appropriate for him to spend his time in federal prison, and that we thought that the Virginia prosecutors would welcome this. At the time, he was about 19 years old, and who knows how long he's going to live, but at $30,000 a year to Virginia taxpayers, we thought they would welcome having him removed from Virginia and sent to the federal penitentiary. But the two local prosecutors, one from Fairfax, one from Prince William County, did not want to do that.
So Paul Liebert in Prince William County prosecuted Muhammad, and Bob Horan in Fairfax County prosecuted Malvo.
They thought that he should not get any concessions whatsoever. We didn't feel it was a concession. I had personal discussions with the prosecutors around the country, and in particular with the two local prosecutors in Virginia who were the ones that put the kibosh on the global plea that we were trying to get. We couldn't believe that they didn't want to do it. We still can't believe they wouldn't go with it. It was the right thing to do, and we weren't giving up a thing.
Okay, so you had a major roadblock towards the global plea, but how did Malvo's testimony go in the case against Muhammad?
You recall during the course of the trial, Muhammad defended himself. He had standby counsel, but the back and forth between Malvo being questioned by the very person who engineered these crimes was quite astonishing to watch. And Malvo never broke. And he told what happened, and he was cross-examined, and he did a fantastic job, told the truth, and we learned from his testimony that day.